Kia ora koutou. Welcome to the New Zealand General Practice Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Joe Scott Jones. Earlier seasons of this podcast focused on joint practice. This season is an opportunity to listen in on monthly conversations I have with Dr. Dave Mapleston, organised for the Pinnacle GP Network. Dave shares insights into important clinical changes he picks up in his reading as a part-time GP and advisor to the Health and Disability Commissioner. I hope you enjoy.
Kia ora, Dave. How are you doing?
Kia ora tātou. Yep, I'm surviving. Had a bit of a break down the South Island for a couple of weeks, which was just beautiful. But back to the harsh reality of a Hamilton winter now.
A breakdown in the South Island, not a breakdown.
No, that's right. Yeah. It was to prevent a breakdown in the North Island.
Very good. Very good. Well, let's kick off with April's clinical snippets.
Yeah, we're a bit late off the mark. Apologies if some of this is old hat. But
apologies for me as well. We had a family bereavement and a quick trip back to the UK. So that's why we're a bit late.
Very justifiable. But anyway, a lot of the stuff is still current. So first thing we're talking about is just adrenaline auto-injectors. And a recent edition of New Zealand Doctor looked at a report by this interesting organisation called the Commission on Human Medicine's Adrenaline Auto-Injector Expert Working Group, which is quite a subspecialty. But it highlights that the latest safety advice, including the recommendations of prescribing two auto-injectors, and that patients should carry an auto-injector at all times. So we know they should have one always available, but for me it was interesting that they were strongly recommending that you prescribe two at a time. So basically, for children attending daycare or school, it means that one auto-injector remains with the child at all times, whether at home or outside, while the second one's stored at the daycare or school for additional coverage. And for older children or adults weighing 50 kgs or more, having two auto-injectors enables them to carry both at all times. And this becomes crucial where more than one dose may be required, offering an added layer of preparedness. So it could include reasons such as ambulance delays, the biphasic reaction, which occurs in about up to 20% of patients, or the initial administration technique being inadequate or inappropriate and a wasted dose.
Yeah.
So it is fully funded.
Yeah, I don't know whether you've had one of those biphasic responses, but I've had that in practice. It's something you just know can happen. But the fact that the EpiPen, this makes such a lot of sense.
I'm pretty sure the guidance, if you manage them in practice, is you've got to monitor them for at least 4 hours following the administration of adrenaline, which means in practice, if you're able to send them up to ED, most of them end up going up to ED for monitoring. But yeah, fully funded for patients meeting the pharmac eligibility criteria, which is previous anaphylactic reaction, which required an ED visit or hospital admission, or a patient who has had a significant anaphylaxis risk as determined by a relevant practitioner, which is you and I. And there's a maximum of two devices per prescription, with additional prescriptions limited to replacement of up to two devices prior to expiry or replacement of devices used for treatment of anaphylaxis. So there's no limit. If they have three bouts of anaphylaxis in a year and end up using up 4 or 5 EpiPens, they're still eligible for replacements.
You wouldn't be prescribing EpiPen for people that haven't had a significant anaphylaxis anyway, would you?
So, I wouldn't have thought so. I'm trying to think. Significant anaphylaxis risk as determined by a relevant practitioner. So I presume maybe if they've had increasingly severe reactions to bee stings, say, maybe not quite meeting the threshold for anaphylaxis, but obviously getting worse each time. I don't know whether you'd consider it in that scenario.
I don't think I would, actually. I think I'd wait until they'd had an anaphylaxis.
When they're out tramping in the South Island.
It is excluding that, isn't it? They have to have had a significant risk to their life, which is what an anaphylaxis is.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the features of anaphylactoid versus anaphylaxis get a bit subtle sometimes as well when you start reading the fine print.
So patients had a significant, it's not has had a significant anaphylaxis risk. Is that the,
that's one of the criteria.
If they have a significant anaphylaxis risk, if you've got that person who's in that escalation, then they're eligible. But if they have to have had a significant risk, then it suggests that they've had an anaphylaxis in the past.
Yeah. So basically, I mean, you've got the two criteria. They're either going to satisfy they've had an anaphylaxis, or you're suspicious that they could have.
Right. Okay.
Which covers both scenarios.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a big change actually for me. So that's awesome.
Moving on to a scam alert. This is just the latest medical council. The latest one arrived today, but the previous medical council newsletter was warning New Zealand practitioners about the fact that professional details of several New Zealand practitioners have been used on a counterfeit telehealth platform known as prescription.com. That's PrescriPson.com. I'm not quite sure how they discovered that their details were being used, but the council's recommendations were all registered doctors to remain vigilant and to monitor any unsolicited or suspicious activities related to your professional credentials, and regularly review your online presence and the use of your professional details on websites outside of your control. And if you do encounter any unauthorized use of your details or receive questionable inquiries that seem related to the scam, council are requesting that you report them immediately to the authorities and to the medical council for further action.
Okay. I did Google myself once and then realized that I should have put safe search on. Is that what they're, are they encouraging us to do that?
Well, I think I went onto this site probably foolishly, but it markets itself as a genuine telehealth site, but there are various scam alerts associated with it.
Wow.
It seems to be global as well, which is
okay. So how do
very
you
interesting?
How do you regularly review your online presence?
Well, maybe that's doing your search with Safe Search on.
Yes. Keep Safe Search on, I would recommend it to anyone.
I think it's possibly slightly narcissistic to go in every couple of days and see how many times you mentioned.
Yes.
The number three is a recent Goodfellow gem, which I found really interesting, in that in my work I get complaints periodically from patients with complicated fractures that haven't united, and they go online and they find that reports that NSAIDs can cause non-union and shouldn't be used for fractures. That was always, it was kind of my historical thinking as well.
Yeah.
But the latest gem looks at a meta-analysis of the effect of NSAIDs on post-fracture bone healing. So it looked at six randomized controlled trials. The risk of non-union was higher in patients who were given NSAIDs after the fracture, with an odds ratio of about 3.5.
Right.
But once they categorized the studies into duration of treatment with NSAIDs, they found those who received them for a short period, that's defined as less than 2 weeks, did not show any significant risk of non-union compared to those who received them for a long period, defined as greater than 4 weeks. And it was predominantly the NSAID that was predominantly to blame was indomethacin, which we would use extremely rarely if it's still available. I'm not even sure if it is. So essentially, I guess the message is it seems fine to give your patient with their freshly broken clavicle some ibuprofen for a few days, you know, until the acute pain settles down without the risk of causing a non-union.
Which I suppose that is good. I mean, the other thing is, are they taking the NSAIDs for longer because they've got a non-union of their fracture?
Well, I don't know I don't know how many of those confounding factors were addressed, or whether it was people that were on long-term NSAIDs for their rheumatoid or some other unrelated factor.
Yeah, and where are they giving indomethacin as a pain relief?
Yeah. I think some of these were older, perhaps older trials, older RCTs that they were analysing as part of the meta-analysis.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, well, that's good news, though.
Yeah, good one. I mean, I can now say, you know, the fact that you had ibuprofen for 3 days is unlikely to be related to the fact that your fracture did not unite.
Yeah, nice.
Now, another one that's been in the news recently, so looking at cognitive testing as part of on-road or assessment for driver's license medicals.
Yeah.
Which, so the New Zealand Herald article last month reported comments from New Zealand cognitive neuroscientist Kerry Spackman, who was actually on national radio a couple of days ago talking about this very topic, criticising the use of the CIMARD or CIMARD MD test and other general cognitive screening tools and looking at whether patients undergoing their senior driving assessment medicals were safe to drive. And he was citing a 2021 Canadian study which concluded that, and these are the words in the conclusion, CIMARD MD should not be used with either healthy drivers or those with cognitive impairment for making decisions about driving. which I found quite interesting. So essentially, he's saying, look, the type of stuff that you're testing for is not relevant to driving, and there's no the when studied, there is no concordance between how you perform in the SIAMID-MD and how well you drive. So,
And is he saying that also then applies to the mocha and
yes, basically saying there's no there at the moment. There is no simple, easily applied cognitive test that could accurately describe whether a patient's fit to drive or not. So if we look at what the requirements are, so the medical aspects of fitness to drive notes that it is, it can be difficult to assess cases where there's some suspicion of mild cognitive impairment. So it does say here it's difficult to assess such cases as there is no single marker that will act as a determinant of fitness to drive a motor vehicle. And it may often be very difficult to determine fitness to drive in the early stages of such conditions when there's little more than mild memory impairment. So in the Waka Kotahi Medical Practitioner's Manual, there's an appendix, Appendix 5, they say, which contains a quick test using road signs that may highlight if an individual has problems in this area. And these are all conditions where impaired judgment would be or could be quite dangerous. And then they talk about the full assessment of driving skills with an occupational therapist trained in driving assessment. So when should driving cease? Driving may be permitted in cases of early dementia, provided that the health practitioner is satisfied that there's no significant loss of insight or judgment, and an individual does not show signs of disorientation or confusion. Standard tests of cognitive function should be used in assessment. So basically they're saying the opposite, that we should be not necessarily screening, but if there's any suspicion, still applying one of the standard cognitive tests. I mean, there are other options. So the on-road safety assessment, this is not the occupational driver's medical assessment. It's basically a drive around with an instructor, usually carried out by a driving instructor, and could possibly be considered when mild cognitive impairment is suspected or reassurance is required regarding the patient's driving habits. And the Waka Kotahi website has quite a lot of information on the on-road safety test, including written advice for candidates, and they actually run training sessions that candidates can go to before sitting the test. And selected AA and VTNZ branches offer the service. So you can go online and actually book the ORST. The assessment's free, but the coaching sessions, if you're a member of AA, they're $80. I think it should be 65 for a member and 80 for a non-member. I've got that the wrong way around there. Oh, sorry, no, members are free. Sorry, if you're aged over 74.
Okay, cool.
Anyway, it shows my cognitive deterioration that I'm confusing this. So the ORST is it's carried out in the patient's vehicle, and it's three parts: basic driving skills and hazard detection, and more complex driving situations and hazard detection. So the average pass rate's around 56%, and if the patient's license is still current, they can continue driving until the license expires. So it's not something you can, purely on the basis of the ORST, that you can withdraw a patient's license. So I think you've got to, I guess, consider all these things before using that resource if it's what you want to do. So it's really almost more, you're pretty sure the patient's fine, no one's got any concerns about their driving, but you just want to be extra sure that you're not signing off somebody who's actually unsafe to drive. So Health Pathways advises medical practitioner that you can't use the driving instructor's report to make a decision on someone's fitness to drive. So I think that's more around, because they passed the ORST, if you've still got significant medical concerns, like they can't push the accelerator down or whatever, that's, we can't use the ORST as a means of guaranteeing safety in that context. The medical OT driving assessment, totally different, covers everything: vision, range of movement, strength, sensation, coordination, judgment, memory, directional orientation, movement and decision-making times, cognition and comprehension, and knowledge of road rules and signs, as well as a practical assessment of driving skill and safety. The downside is the occupational therapy assessments are only subsidised in a very few areas of New Zealand, and cost up to $1,000. And currently in the Waikato, I think there's a couple of months wait to even even be able to seen for to be seen for one.
Right.
But
And they are
the
subsidised in some areas.
well, the Canterbury Health Pathways just say refer your patient to the Burwood Driving Assessment Unit.
Okay.
So assuming it is, you know, that is done for free, that would
Yeah.
be another example of the postcode lottery on how, you know, what services you can access.
Yeah.
But certainly, I think it's worth just reviewing the Waka Kotahi Health Practitioner's Guide in relation to your patients with cognitive impairment. And Goodfellow Unit has a good how-to guide on driving assessment of patients with dementia using a case example as well.
As I were quite lucky, because this is such a contentious area for patients, obviously, that they're, you know, if you had a patient who you were concerned about, most of them just trust that, you know, we're making the right decision, and we do it in a way that's compassionate, and we support them with the implications of, you know, now you're no longer going to be able to drive, and they just ex a lot of patients accept, you know, there might be some pushback. But they don't. I've never had a significant complaint from a patient who I've said is no longer fit to drive. And looking at that, there's actually a whole lot of wriggle room that they could complain about, if I've just done a straightforward assessment in my practice,
Absolutely.
and not done in some sort of on-road test.
I think the nightmare is that you deem someone fit to drive and they go out and cause a major accident. Then you're asked to say, oh, you know, how did you, you know, on what basis did you say they were fit to drive?
Ah,
And
I'm
to be able
sure.
to demonstrate that. And I discussed this at our peer group meeting the other night. And the thinking, I mean, in part, one of my thoughts was, well, if there's no suspicion, particular suspicion that this patient is cognitively impaired, by getting them to do a screening test, you've got to know what you're going to do with the results. So if it does show impairment, you know, you're then opening a potential can of worms.
Yeah.
On the other side of things, you might detect early dementia, which you can then support the patient with and manage at a much earlier time. So there are pros and cons, but there've certainly been letters to the editor of various papers that I read from very disgruntled patients who have failed a cognitive screening test and then been failed their license on the purely, it seems, on the basis of the screening test.
Yeah. Well, that's good to hear about the AA and the VTNZ, potential for them to do at least an on-road assessment of some kind. That's at a reasonable cost. So.
So those are free. It
Oh, the
was the
assessment's free.
coaching session. Yeah, the coaching
Coaching's okay.
sessions
Okay,
were
right.
the was what were cost money. So,
Oh, that's great.
but it's a complex, nightmarish issue, really. And I think the other thing is just to be sure you're actually well documenting the rationale for your decisions, in
Yeah.
case there's pushback. One of the members of my peer group had exactly this happen, that they'd been approached by the police after the A patient that had a recent driving test had been killed in an accident where they pulled out in front of a truck, to say, show us, you know, basically show us how you thought this patient was fit to drive. And the health pathways are also good in that they give you advice on breaking the news that you are no longer fit to drive, including how you access things like half price taxi fares and other ways of maintaining a degree of independence,
Yeah,
in
and
the absence of
not to
license.
take the scissors out and cut their license up in front of them, that sort of thing.
Not usually, but
Usually.
perhaps if they've another issue that comes out of this is if you have signed somebody as unfit and they storm out of the waiting room and go down the road to somebody that places them as fit, what position are you in? I mean, theoretically, or in fact, factually, I think you have to notify Waka Kotahi that they're unfit to drive. And if you get them to sign the driver's license form first, that then takes off any, basically that it's saying that you can use this information that you have to determine their fitness to drive.
Sneaky.
If you don't, if they haven't signed it, you know, they may push back on the fact that you've provided
Ah.
medical information to Waka Kotahi without their consent.
Well, that is interesting.
So yeah, well, interesting bits and pieces. Anyway, nightmare. Let's go on to something that's slightly more straightforward. So these are just all recent medication communications, MedSafe, pointing out if you've got a patient with new onset puzzling eczema, just check that they haven't been on a calcium channel blocker. So there's a phenomenon, calcium channel blocker associated eczema, which can occur even up to several years after initiation of the drug. The reports they have on file, most were related with phlodipine, one with diltiazem, and they're just encouraging reporting of any new onset eczema cases in patients that are on calcium channel blockers so they can further determine whether there is a cause for concern. If you've got patients who have bought a natural over-the-counter remedy for their eczema and they're suddenly saying this is incredible, but they've got striae forming, they may have got their hands on Natura Cocoa Moisturising Cream or Doc Apo Moisturiser Soothing Cream, which both of which have been found to contain potent corticosteroids, which is not listed in the product ingredients.
Oh my goodness.
So they've been withdrawn. But if a patient not currently using steroid creams presents with symptoms consistent with the use of potent steroids, then consider if they've managed to get their hands on one of these products. So at least it was picked up. But yeah, I'm not quite sure how they managed to slip through the system. Novo Nordisk has given advance notice to Pharmac that supply of three of its insulin products will be discontinued from 30th of September 2024. These are quite commonly used products: Penmix 30, Penmix 50, and Mixitard 30. So it's recommended patients using these products be transitioned to suitable alternatives and expect further advice from Pharmac in the near future. So again, just a chance to review your type 2s on insulin and figure out if they're, or make sure they're on all the other fancy drugs, as well as starting to look at their new insulin regime. And then finally, just an update on estradiol gel. So Pharmac's put out an RFP for supply of the gel earlier in April. Suppliers must apply by 30th of May. So hopefully there'll be some products available within the next few months or before the end of the year. So that's the estradiol gel.
Right. Okay. So that'll be, we don't currently have estradiol gel.
No, and it's been
No.
an issue with the shortage of the patches,
Yeah.
and that's one of the reasons why I think they're trying to fast track the issue as well. Chasing results, so bells of celebration ringing, maybe slightly. There's now, well, it's good for me because I've now got a standard that I can refer to when there are issues with chasing results. So hopefully most listeners have caught up with this, but Te Whatu Ora has published a document outlining four high-level principles which are aimed at patient safety and equitable health outcomes. And they're clarifying the areas of responsibility and hopefully reducing ambiguity, in particular when there are transfers between secondary and primary care. So I'll just go through them briefly. Principle one, which there's no particular change, the clinician who orders an investigation, the requester, is responsible, either personally or delegated, through defined team processes for review and actioning of the results, regardless of subsequent transfer of care, unless explicitly agreed to and documented otherwise. So that's further defined a bit later on. Second principle, where information is shared to add value to care and continuity, copying results to other clinicians or service providers is appropriate, but clear separate communication is required if the recipient is expected to act on the result. So I think that's more the shared care, patients on DMARDs, maybe lithium, but where there's ongoing use of ongoing blood test monitoring. Principle three is probably the one that will still upset some people, which is any clinician copied into a significantly abnormal result needs to ensure appropriate action has been taken. So that's irrespective of who ordered the test. And that is really a patient safety issue, and I think it just reflects on one of our roles being an advocate for the safety and well-being of our patients. So essentially it means if you get a chest X-ray result CC'd from ED and it says, show the discharge summary says nothing seen, and this formal report says, there's a suspicious mass in the right upper quadrant, the right upper lobe, you don't just file it and assume that ED is going to act on it. And principle four, I think, is probably the main change, which is the requirements for regular monitoring and follow-up must be agreed between the referring and receiving clinicians. So that's closing the loop. That means, in effect, if you are required or being asked to follow up a result of a test you have not ordered, the requester needs your acceptance of that responsibility. And you can decline it if you don't feel it's suitable. But basically, once you have accepted that responsibility, usually verbally it will be, but certainly documented, then it becomes your responsibility to follow up the result.
Yeah. So the looking at these and the to keep the patients safe in many situations, it's that closed loop conversation, that closed loop of communication that needs to happen. And there are, very basic ways that can be done. Somebody might ring you up from the hospital that I've done this test. Will you make sure that you follow up the result? But we all know that that's an incredibly clunky, time wasting occupying sort of activity for everybody. And there would be smart IT solutions to allow that closed loop communication to be automatic almost, or to be sort of set within the system without taking up everybody's time. And until we've got those things in place, we're going to need to do our best, really. And we were talking about this as a group across, well, nationally, and coming to the conclusion that because there's so much variation between all the different hospital systems and each of the hospital teams, that at the moment it's this is these are going to have to be negotiated and applied hospital by hospital and team by team, really. It is a fantastic start. It's actually much more robust than I had feared. We've been watching this develop over the last 3 years, and it's landed with pretty good principles, I think. But actually now the application of it is going to take quite a bit of work.
Yeah, and I think it would be, I mean, obviously it would be great if there was a consistent application. But as you say, the IT systems between areas vary so much. There is an issue around CCing of results and policies around which results should be copied and which shouldn't. And the document actually says copying of results is not a transfer of care, and results should not be routinely copied to any other clinician at the time of request. But I think some primary care practitioners will want to get some results, or at least have them easily accessible without clunky interfaces and things like that. So it'll settle down. It'll evolve over time, I think, or fine-tune over time to be an efficient process, hopefully.
So there's a lot of work to do, and but it gives us some, as you say, guiding principles around this really thorny issue, which impacts on the workload in general practice. But I actually think principle three is really, really important, that any clinician copied into a significantly abnormal result needs to ensure appropriate action is taken. If the principle one and principle two are applied, in that you've had a conversation, you've engaged in a definite plan, as principle four implies, principle three should never apply. But if you're because those others imply that closed loop conversation, so you should never really be in that situation of being copied into something that's significantly abnormal without having agreed a plan. But when it does happen,
That's
you
right.
still
And it's,
patient's got to be safe.
yeah. And I think as this, settles down, the times when you might out of the blue receive an abnormal result and have to follow it up to find out whether somebody's done something or not will be,
Reduce, yeah.
will not be that often. So that's, a little bit of clarity amongst what was previously slightly cloudy. And hopefully it means those dreaded words, GP to chase, will become part of history rather than a frequent flyer.
We will see.
Number seven, really just a recent study that confirms the change to the cellulitis protocol in health pathways has been efficacious. So it's a retrospective study from Dunedin comparing the safety and efficacy of outpatient parenteral antimicrobial therapy versus oral antimicrobial therapy in the treatment of cellulitis. So basically, it was a change from IV cafezolin and probenecid to the oral flucloxacillin and probenecid. And comparing outcomes before and after the change, there were no significant differences in the rates of clinical treatment failure. So they were about 15% versus 14%, respectively. No difference in treatment changes due to intolerance or inpatient admission within 28 days. And the pathway change was also associated with substantial cost savings and a significant reduction in scheduled ED attendances or re-attendances, basically because of the decreased need for IV support. So that was, I think that just reinforces that we should be using the oral meds pathway rather than persisting with the IV pathway for the time being. But the health pathways does run through this and would give you some scenarios where perhaps you might be considering the IV pathway. But essentially they are talking about, in terms of just general management, and I keep coming back, importance of screening for sepsis is emphasized. So really any patient who could, you know, who has an infection really needs, they need to do some basic screening for sepsis. So that's emphasized with additional practical advice, such as when wound swabs and blood tests, including cultures, might be considered, certainly not routinely. Treat Māori and Pacific patients early. Māori and Pacific have high rates of hospitalization due to sepsis and cellulitis. So start effective treatment early and arrange a review acceptable to the patient to monitor progress. Be aware that natural history of cellulitis shows increasing redness and swelling within the first 48 hours. So if the patient's improving overall at 48 to 72 hours after oral therapy, do not start IV therapy solely due to the persistence of redness or swelling. And always reassess moderate cellulitis at 48 hours and monitor fever. That's the most important indicator of response to antibiotics. So again, you know, on the review of notes, when people have complained about management of cellulitis, I don't that often see scheduled review at 48 hours for the moderate cases. And quite often I'll see if patients have come back in 24 hours saying, oh, it's still red. I see transfer onto IV antibiotics at that point. So worthwhile having a squiz at the pathway.
Yeah.
And last quick couple, gynecology ones. So January this year, regulatory approval was received in the UK to extend the use of Mirena for contraception only to 8 years from the previously recommended 5 years.
Okay.
So that in the USA, the FDA did the same approval in August of 2022. So basically, I think we can say now safely that for contraception, Mirena can be used for 8 years. But if you are, and it's supported by evidence for efficacy, if you're doing that in New Zealand, though, and again, I think it would be quite reasonable because the international evidence and practice is there, you would still be required to inform the patient that such use in New Zealand is off-label because currently it's licensed for 5 years for contraception in New Zealand. So essentially what I'm saying is it seems very reasonable to tell a patient using the Mirena for contraception, this is going to be effective for 8 years. It's licensed in New Zealand for 5 years, but if you're happy to leave it in for 8 years based on the evidence, that's a perfectly reasonable thing to do and just document their consent. But there's been no change to approval or recommendations internationally for the use of Mirena for the management of heavy menstrual bleeding or endometrial protection as part of hormone replacement therapy. So they're both 5 years still. That's solely for Mirena being used for contraception, that the 8 year extension seems reasonable. And finally, just an interesting discussion that came up the other day around management of patients with endometriosis or history of significant endometriosis management after menopause. So the Australasian Menopause Society has published a statement, and I've put a link to that in the snippets. But they note that oral contraceptive pills which contain estrogen and progestin are often effective in controlling endometriosis premenopausally, and that's by prevention of ovulation. But oophorectomy, so basically medical treatment or surgical treatment, sorry, getting rid of the ovaries, or naturally by menopause, has a major impact on the treatment of endometriosis or the manifestation of endometriosis. So essentially what they're saying is that if you want to protect women from the effects of estrogen deprivation following menopause, but they have a significant history of premenopausal endometriosis, the current recommendations favour continuous combined estrogen-progestogen preparations instead of unopposed estrogens, even after hysterectomy. And the reason for this is there have been case reports of endometriosis recurrence or malignant transformation of extrauterine endometriotic deposits in women with a history of extensive endometriosis treated with unopposed estrogen therapy following menopause.
Wow.
So basically getting endometrial cancer in a deposit on your bowel or whatever. So messages, yeah, if the patient has a significant history of endometriosis premenopausally and you're using menopause hormone therapy post menopause or peri and post menopause, even if they've had a hysterectomy, to use the continuous combined estrogen progestogen regime.
Wow. So that's really interesting because there'll be the potential for endometrial tissue to be intra-abdominal in people who are asymptomatic. And if the rationale is that unopposed estrogen increases the risk of transformation of those cells into cancer, I wonder how long it'll be before we're going to be advised to use not to use unopposed estrogen in anybody.
Yeah. Well, they're saying here the evidence is sparse, but there has certainly have been case reports. So it's not a it's I would say it's not for a formal guideline, but that's certainly the recommendation from the Australasian Menopause Society.
Brilliant, brilliant. There's so much there, Dave. Thank you so much. I think the adrenaline autoinjectors, being able to try one or two, and the being free, not to or to Google myself regularly and watch out for scabs. The non-steroidals are okay in the early stages of a fracture of this, or protect. They're an option, basically. We talked quite a lot about the on-road safety tests and dementia, and then there was a range of medication stuff that you talked about. Both, so I can use Natura Cocoa Moisturizer to treat my calcium channel blocker induced eczema. Maybe use it sparingly, perhaps.
I should think so, yes.
And then that important document around the chasing results, the principles, that basically we're going to need to discuss, I think, discuss with the PHO and the AU, what the implications of that and what's being done on a hospital by hospital basis. But there's a lot of hope there for reducing that GP to chase, and then use the oral pathway for cellulitis management because it's effective. And then those two gynae issues, the marina. I wonder if that marina is working just as an IUD, so it's actually sort of causing a mechanical irritation. Because if the progesterone has run out, which is why you can't use it for endometrial protection as part of hormone replacement therapy, but it's still sitting there as a working like a just a physical irritant.
Yeah. I think there's still a release of progesterone, which enhances the which enhance enha it's a bit like the copper in the copper versus the old Lippi's loop, I suppose, that the chemical enhances the effectiveness of it, but obviously not sufficient to prevent the endometrial proliferation that's associated with the heavy menstrual bleeding.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And then the endometriosis, and to consider, I suppose when somebody's got a significant history of endometriosis, it's not uncommon for them to have had a total abdominal hysterectomy and a oophorectomy, is it?
Absolutely,
And
absolutely, and I think they emphasise the importance of not shying away from menopause hormone therapy in these patients because they still need bone and cardiovascular protection, but just to make sure you're using the unopposed
not
the both continuous opposed therapies. So.
Thanks, Dave. April snippets in the bag.
Cool.
And
We'll
yeah, we'll see you in
see you in May.
May.
Thanks for listening. Please like and share this podcast if you found it useful. The show notes on the podcast website contain links to all the resources that we discussed. A video version of this podcast is available on the Pinnacle Practice website at pinnacle.co.nz. Ka kite anō.